Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 9th, 2015. And this says before the first cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday. I think it's Thursday. Anyway, it's supposed to be. We are at 46 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. We had our first thunderstorm yesterday. It was awesome. Didn't last for too long, but it was thundering and lightning over the lake, so that was great. I mean, spring actually has finally sprung, which makes my day. And yes, that last little blurb of snow that was left on my deck is now gone with the rain yesterday. So that's a good thing. ATVs can't be too far behind. All right, so where are we going to kick it off today? We're going to continue from where we left off yesterday. Yesterday's show was titled Monsanto Big Pharma Biowarfare Project and Red Buttons. We had dug into a bunch of different stories, looked at some stuff that we had looked at before in regards to the history of the biowarfare program. And there was a story by John Rappaport that Antimedia had published a few days back that had looked at potentially some dirty stuff going on in Hawaii between Monsanto Biopharma and the biological weapons program. Like I said yesterday, I am not so sure about Hawaii, but absolutely it could be. But we made those connections long ago between some of the things that are going on in the biotech industry, especially with these communicable diseases, viruses, bacteria, the genome project, and all this research that's been done, the sprinkling of DARPA money everywhere. While I was doing the annotations for the show yesterday, I dug up something that I kind of wanted to kick things off with today. At one point yesterday, we were looking at, I think it was the Black Plague that has cropped up again, this time in Arizona. And they found that it is spreading via fleas in the prairie dogs. And one of the things that I had mentioned was we had looked at some of that before in regards to the historical biological weapons program in the United States, where they'd been using insects, namely mosquitoes and ticks at that time, to spread disease. And I had kind of postulated that I bet if we had looked closely enough, we would find that there was some connection between also messing around with fleas, the bubonic plague, and Plum Island. Well, yes. So I did a little bit of digging, and I came up with some extremely interesting information yesterday. So let's kick it off here, because then I want to continue on some other things that I found. But check this out. So there was a gentleman named Eric, E-R-I-C-H, Eric, the German spelling, Traub. Eric Traub, 1906 to 1985, was a German veterinarian and scientist slash virologist who specialized in foot and mouth disease, Rinderpest, and Newcastle disease. Traub was a member of the National Socialist Motors Corp, the NSKK, a Nazi motors corp from 1938 to 1942. He worked directly for Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, as the lab chief of the Nazi leading bioweapons facility on Rhymes Island. Traub was rescued from the Soviet zone of Germany after World War II. And what? He was brought to the United States in 1949 under the auspices of the U.S. government program, Operation Paperclip, yes, affectionately so. Wow, we've met so many of these guys now, meant to exploit the post-war scientific knowledge in Germany and deny it to the Soviet Union. Let's look at his career now. Early career in war during the 1930s, he studied on a fellowship at the where? The Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. Yes, in Princeton, New Jersey. So this was like in the 1930s. He studied in New Jersey while he was I don't get that. How did we get him in Germany before we rescued him? He studied at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research in Princeton, New Jersey, mentored by Richard Shope, performing research on vaccines and viruses. including pseudo rabies virus and lymphocystic chloral meningitis virus. And during his stay in the United States, Traub and his wife were listed as members of the German American Bund, a pro-Nazi German American club just 30 miles west of Plum Island in Yampak, Long Island, from 1934 to 1935. Traub worked at the University of Giessen, Germany, from 1938 to 1942. He was a member of the Nazi NSKK, a motorist corps, from 1938 to 1942. And the NSKK was declared a condemned but not criminal organization at the Nuremberg trials. From 1942 to 48, Traub worked as lab chief at the Reich Institute for Virus Diseases of Animals on Reims Island, a German animal virus research institute in the Baltic Sea, now named the Frederick Loeffler Institute. The institute was headed by Professor Dr. Otto Waldman from 1909 to 1948, while Traub was vice president. So Traub is no slouch. This guy was well-connected, elbow-rubbing, and worked at some very high-end viral research institutes. The institute at Reims Island sounds so much like Plum Island, so he must have felt really at home. Was a dual-use facility during the Second World War, where at least some biological warfare experiments were conducted. It had been founded originally in 1909 and 10 to study foot and mouth disease in animals, and by World War II employed about 20 scientists and had a staff of 70 to 120 scientists. Hans Christoph Nagel, a veterinarian and biological warfare expert for the German army, conducted experiments there, as did Traub. The institute was administered under the Innenministerium, which I don't even know what that is, the Ministry of the Interior, which SS Heinrich Himmler took over in 1943. The chain of command was Himmler, then Dr. Leonardo Conte, Kurt Blom, Waldman, and then Traub. Traub specialized in viral and bacterial diseases. He was assisted by Anna Berger, who also was later brought to the United States after the war to work with the Navy's biological warfare program. So, you know, we had always kind of postulated that there were these connections between Operation Paperclip, Plum Island, biological warfare, and the scientists that came over here from Germany. But I had never really seen a lot of proof of that until I found this entry yesterday. On orders from Himmler and Blom, the deputy Reich health leader and head of the German biological warfare program, Traub worked on weaponizing foot and mouth disease virus, which had been reported to have been dispersed by aircraft. And how many times have we talked about experiments done via aircraft onto cattle and reindeer in Russia? In 1944, Blom sent Traub to go pick up a strain of Rinderpest virus in Turkey. So how nice, Turkey was providing them with viruses. And upon his return, this strain actually proved inactive, and therefore plans for a Rinderpest product were shelved. All right, let's look a little bit at his post-war history. Immediately after the war, Traub was trapped in the Soviet zone of Allied-occupied Germany, which actually a friend and I were just talking about after the war with Germany and the split between the U.S. and Russia and all the horrible things that happened in eastern Germany after the fact. I still need to watch those videos, but I guess it was pretty horrific. He was forced to work with the Soviets from his lab on Reims Island. In July of 1948, the British evacuated Eric Traub from Reims Island as a, quote, high-priority intelligence target, since it was now in the Soviet zone and they feared that Traub was assisting in their biological warfare program. Traub denied this, however, claiming that his only interest was in foot-and-mouth diseases in animals. Trout was brought to the United States in 1949 under the auspices of the U.S. government program Operation Paperclip, meant to exploit scientific knowledge in Germany and deny it to the Soviet Union. From 1949 to 53, he was associated with the Naval Medical Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. Again, remember, a lot of those organizations, military and government organizations up in Maryland, Baltimore, and that region, you know, that's where the NSA is headquartered. That's where a lot of the biological warfare institutions were located. And we'll see that here when we go down a little bit further. Just months into his Operation Paperclip contract, which I didn't know that they had contracts either. I thought they just brought them over here and like, hey, you're an American. You're going to be an American as long as you help us with our research. But maybe that's what the contract said. Otherwise, we'll out you as a Nazi sympathizer and put you up on the Nuremberg trials. Traub was asked to meet with U.S. scientists from Fort Detrick, which was the Army's biological warfare headquarters in Frederick, Maryland. As a noted German authority on viruses, he was asked to consult on their animal disease program from a biological warfare perspective. Traub discussed work done at Reich Research Institute for virus diseases of animals on Rhymes Island during World War II for the Nazis and work done after the war there for the Russians. Traub gave a detailed explanation of the secret operation at the Institute and his activities there, and this information provided the groundwork for Fort Detrick's offshore germ warfare animal disease lab on Plum Island. This, the information that they received from this guy, Eric Traub, served as the groundwork for Fort Detrick's offshore germ warfare animal disease lab on Plum Island. That is very significant. His publicly published research from his time in the United States reports disease research not directly related to weaponization. In 1951, he published a report for the Naval Medical Research Institute on Newcastle disease virus in chickens and mammalian blood cells. 2 years later, he published a paper for the Navy on the mechanisms of immunity in chickens to Newcastle and possible roles of cellular factors. Also in 1953, he published another paper for the Navy with Worth I. Capps on the foot and mouth disease virus and methods for rapid adaptation. He also served as an expert on foot and mouth disease for the FAO of the UN in Bogota, Colombia from 51 to 52, in Tehran, Iran from 63 to 67, and in Ankara, Turkey from 69 to 71. All right, so now let's dig down to the bottom here. Bioweapons research in theory, and this is where it really gets interesting. Because we had been looking at ticks, fleas, mosquitoes, and things of that nature. Well, check this out. In theory, insects of all types, particularly the biting species, can be used as disease vectors in a biological warfare program. And, of course, the United States no longer has one officially. Germany, Japan, Britain, Russia, and the U.S. all conducted experiments along these lines during the Second World War, and the Japanese used such insect-borne diseases against both soldiers and civilians in China. This was one of the reasons that President Franklin Roosevelt and Secretary of War Henry Stimson ordered the creation of an American biological warfare program in 1942, which was headquartered at Camp Detrick, Maryland, and eventually this grew to a very large facility of 245 buildings and a $60 million budget, including an entomological weapons department that mass-produced flies, lice, and mosquitoes as disease vectors. Got 245 buildings dedicated to biowarfare using bugs? Now, this is way bigger than I ever imagined. And $60 million budget in 1942? I mean, this is massive. Although the British bioweapon facility at Porton Down concentrated on the production of anthrax bombs, it also conducted experiments on insects as vectors. After the war, the Army's 406th Medical General Laboratory in Japan cooperated with former scientists from Unit 731. Hey, we talked about that one. In experimenting with many different insect vectors, including lice, flies, mosquitoes, ticks, hey, ding, ding, fleas, spiders, beetles, as well as many others, to carry a wide variety of diseases from cholera to meningitis. And at Fort Detrick in the late 1940s, Theodore Roseberry also rated insect vectors very highly, and its entomological division had at least three insect vectors weapons ready for use by 1950. Some of these were later tested at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah and allegedly used during the Korean War as well. And we found that out. They were accused. So here's something that I want to point out to you, though, and this is what got me to this little tidbit in Wikipedia. We had been looking at bubonic plague and fleas in Arizona. We had discussed how there have been a couple outbreaks over the last few years. I remember one in Montana, and there may have even been one up in Wyoming. There was a potential case, I believe it was last year in Colorado, they thought, and it might have actually ended up being another disease, but I thought at one point maybe they were talking about bubonic or maybe it was pneumonic plague. But check this out. One of the things that it said in that story yesterday is that it had never been seen before 1950. And I made the postulation that I bet if we dug hard enough, we would be able to make a connection between the bioweapons program, fleas, 1950 on Plum Island. And guys, this just made it. The stuff I just read here, let's read it again. They had been experimenting after World War II. They discovered that they could use different insect vectors, including lice, flies, mosquitoes, ticks, fleas. They had done testing. Says in his entomological division, he had at least three insect vectored weapons ready for use by 1950. And where did they test them? At the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Guys, I think that it probably isn't a stretch of the imagination. If we hadn't seen bubonic plague here in this country before 1950, and they were doing research with fleas and ticks, mosquitoes and flies at the Dugway Proving Grounds after 1950, that we probably are responsible for being here in this country. Traub, so this is this Eric Traub we've been talking about, visited the Plum Island Animal Disease Center in New York on at least three occasions in the 1950s. The Plum Island facility, operated by the Department of Agriculture, conducted research on foot and mouth disease of cattle, one of Traub's areas of expertise. Traub was actually offered a leading position at Plum Island in 1958, which he officially declined. It has been alleged that the United States performed bioweapons research at Plum Island. Well, I don't know. I mean, we just read the facts here. I don't think there's any alleging going on. It sure looks pretty clear to me what was going on there. Fort Terry on Plum Island was part of the U.S. Biological Warfare Program in 1944 to 1946, working on veterinary testing in connection with the weaponization of brucellosis. After the war, research on biological weapons continued at Pine Bluff in Arkansas and in Fort Detrick, Maryland, while officially, at least, Plum Island was transferred to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. From 1949, Plum Island also conducted work on biological weapons against animals and livestock, such as foot and mouth disease, rinderpest, Newcastle disease, African swine fever, and plague, ding, ding, as well as malaria and birds. Traub's research from the Second World War onward involved at least three of these, all dangerous only, so they say, wink, wink, to non-human animal species. So there you go. I mean, listen to that and weep. If there ever was evidence for me to go ding, 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 to say that we found a little bit of a key there. Eric Traub, I'm going to need to dig into him a little bit more. And some of these other people that he was involved with in these entomological biowarfare divisions. I honestly didn't know that it was so huge using insects as disease vectors globally. And so that's something we should definitely pay attention to. So we were looking at bubonic plague then just like appearing, like I said, in Arizona, never before been here before 1950. And how many times have we seen that over and over again with these quote unquote outbreaks? I talked about yesterday too, where in England, I thought it was 1,300 corpses, but I found the story yesterday. Hold on. I think it was like 3,000 plague victims that they had to dig up because they were putting a new train line in London, and they found all these bubonic plague victims buried in pits underneath. And I mentioned yesterday that I read like six different stories on that, and only one of the six stories had actually mentioned that they were planning on using some of these corpses to get samples to be able to study, quote unquote, study the bubonic plague that killed so many millions across Europe in the Middle Ages. Well, how convenient, right? We're not doing biological warfare research. You know, it's just like the bird flu. We talked about that yesterday, too. You know, they get their hands on that... the 1918 flu that killed millions globally. And what, scientists discovered how to make it more virulent, and then not only make it more virulent, but then publish the results online in publications. Well, check this out. So we have this bubonic plague thing. So now I see back, this was on March 19th, so it was maybe 3 weeks ago. Here, I have us all set up to play clip. I went a whole week without being able to play clips properly, so I need to take advantage. There was a story here on Pigmind's channel back about 3 weeks ago about a school in Kansas. And remember what we talked about? Where did they move? Hold on, I got to disconnect so this hiss stops for a second. We found out they're moving Plum Island, right? That they started moving all of the viral material to a new location where they're planning on building a high security facility. It's not quite done yet, but hey, we couldn't lose any time in research, so we moved it to the University of Kansas, which I couldn't even believe. Out of like this level 3 or level 4 facility, now we moved it to the University of Kansas, and they've continued the research. Let's not pay attention to the fact that it's right in the middle of Tornado Alley, and they're working on building the new bio-research facility. Not quite done yet, but how convenient, about 3 weeks ago, what turns up at a school in Kansas? Well, let's find out.
In the first week of March, doctors diagnosed one Olathe Northwest student with a tuberculosis disease. Now 27 have the infection.
The next step will be for them to have a chest x-ray. The purpose of that chest x-ray is to rule out tuberculosis disease.
The TB disease is highly contagious, and if left untreated, can be fatal. The TB infection is not contagious, but the virus does stay in the body. More than 300 students and staffers were tested after coming in contact with the sick student. 8% tested positive.
It's going to be there. It's not going to leave the body. In a normal circumstance, like I said, only 5 to 10% get active disease. Most of the time, your own immunity will wall it off, and it's a non-issue.
Doctors say the active virus is airborne and usually affects the lungs. The student who has the disease will remain at home until his symptoms clear up. Those with the infection will return to school on Monday.
There would be no reason for them not to, because, again, they're not symptomatic, so they're not able to transmit the infection.
So, you know, I don't know. When I saw that, I was like, well, how interesting. Just out of the blue, we have 27 kids in Kansas that are diagnosed with tuberculosis. And that, I mean, it's out there, but it's not like it's out there. And, you know, Kansas now where they're putting this new facility. And it was right at the same time I came across a story out of RT. This actually was a couple weeks later. Hungary mummies. Hungary as in the country, not hungry as in you need food or brains. Hungary mummies. 200-year-old corpses shed light on the historic origins of TB. Wow, how convenient. Now we dug up 3,000 bodies with bubonic plague. Now we dug up 200-year-old mummies loaded with tuberculosis. And they're studying the origins. Mummies discovered in a Hungarian church crypt have helped scientists uncover multiple tuberculosis strains, multiples, that ravaged Europe in the 18th century, suggesting that, unlike now, a person could have more than one strain. The 256 bodies were discovered in 1994 in a secret crypt in the Dominican church of the town of Vak in central Hungary on Tuesday. And the story was from April 8th. On Tuesday, a combined research team from Warwick University, Warwick Medical School, and Budapest History Museum published their study on some of the bodies in the scientific journal Nature Communications. By tracing the lineage and spread of tuberculosis, they hope to help fight the disease in modern times. And they did discover a direct link. All of the samples from the 200-year-old secret Hungarian crypt shared the genetic signature of the modern Euro-American tuberculosis strain, which, according to the World Health Organization, still causes about 1 million cases every year. Moreover, most of the corpses showed signs of more than one strain of TB, where modern patients only suffer one strain each. The research yielded a total of 14 tuberculosis genomes. 5 of the 8 bodies in our study yielded more than one type of tuberculosis. Remarkably, from one individual, we obtained evidence from 3 distinct strains, said lead author Professor Mark Palin from the Warwick Medical School in a statement. Using the gene sequences found in the bodies, the researcher traced their diseases back to a common ancestor found in the late Roman period. This reinforces a predominant current theory, which says that TB is only 6,000 years old. Other researchers had suggested it was discovered in humanity's ancestors hundreds of thousands of years ago. Another valuable discovery was the pattern of TB spread across 18th century towns, which revealed that whole families were ravaged by this gruesome disease. We found evidence of an intimate link between strains from the middle-aged mother and her grown-up daughter, suggesting that both family members died from this devastating infection, said another of the study's authors, Gemma Kay. The bodies were first discovered during a routine reconstruction of the church. A worker stumbled upon them after he tapped a brick wall and heard it was hollow. He removed one of the bricks and, oh, lucky him, found a stack of coffins. The bodies had mummified naturally due to the extremely dry environment. And it has been suggested that the process was aided by pine chips on the bottoms of the coffins, which absorbed the moisture in the bodily fluids. Pine resin might also have helped ward off parasites and microbes. Many of the bodies had been wealthy Catholics. Their stories and details of their deaths described in local records, which had helped researchers work immensely. The discovery was not a treasure trove for epidemiologists either. The coffins themselves are an example of fine craftsmanship, blah blah blah, inscribed in Hungarian, German, or Latin. Articles of clothing and other items were buried there, and they were in excellent condition. Yes, some of the discoveries, including the mummies themselves, are now on display in the Memento Mori Museum close to the church where they were found. You know, I don't know, call me crazy, it just to me seems like there is a lot of this type of stuff going on, especially now that we have cracked the genome. They want to get their hands on everything and anything to sequence it and see what they can do. And as they're messing around with our immune systems and all these newfangled types of vaccinations using RNAi and manipulating the immune system, you know, like I said yesterday and many times before, I mean, we've looked at story after story where there has been uninformed consent or no consent whatsoever of populations time and time again historically, where things have been tested on them and they never were aware. There was another one story that came out. This might have been a little while ago. This is the beginning of April, so it was about a week ago. Polio-like. Now, didn't we see a story yesterday that the UN announced that there will be lots of Ebola-like diseases that are going to kill all kinds of people here in the near future? Well, now a story coming out of IT, polio-like enterovirus could be behind the paralysis of over 100 children. And this was that enterovirus that had been going around, oh, I think it was right before that quote-unquote measles outbreak happened. It was in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, I believe, where there were a lot of these kids that were getting this enterovirus, and they weren't really sure where it was coming from. But there had been paralysis that was involved with some of the children. Well, now they're calling it a polio-like enterovirus. More than 100 children in 34 states. Notice how a bunch of these different outbreaks, too, that we've been looking at here recently are like in 30, 32, 34 states. I mean, this is really nuts. And in one of the stories we heard yesterday, too, they were saying that the reason why these outbreaks are so big is because, oh, I don't know, people travel. Well, gee, that seems to be a new thing, huh? Like people haven't traveled before. Remember, too, we even looked at that new dog flu that just appeared. And goddamn, people travel. Watch your dog because it's going to be devastating and spread everywhere. I mean, really, this to me is very concerning. There is a picture that is being painted here. And we see again the drawstrings on the bag starting to close as they're talking about now not only mandatory vaccinations in many states for children without religious exemption any longer, or, you know, your objector status. But now there's that plan from 2015 to 2020 to get every adult up to date on their vaccines as well. And, you know, aren't these grubby biopharma companies that all of our Congress are invested in rubbing their grubby, dirty hands together looking at Q2, 3, and 4 profits? You know, this just, get me wound up. Get me started. Beep, beep, beep. Red button. All right, more than 100 children in 34 states develop polio-like paralysis in an arm or a leg since a respiratory outbreak last August. Paralysis from a respiratory outbreak. Wow, that's a new one to me. The study published in the Lancet Medical Journal said a strain of enterovirus D68 is probably the leading culprit. Now, we looked into that as well, and I remember, I'm not going to talk out of my ass here, but there was something funky about that enterovirus that it hadn't been seen here in like 30 years or something, and boop, it just popped up. There was another contagion, and I don't remember what that one was either, but out of the blue, hadn't been seen in 50 years, and oh, it just appeared in Japan. I'll have to look that one up. That was quite a number of months ago when all of this, you know, contagion, these contagions we haven't seen in a generation just start appearing all over the board. It says between August and October of 2014, reports began to surface of an increasing number of children admitted to hospitals in a number of states, all involving a respiratory illness with a neurological complication. In the end, as many as 115 children from 34 states were infected. And honestly, this was right before the measles outbreak because this is when the whole vaccine question began. Like, is there a vaccination against enterovirus? And oh my God, it hasn't been seen in so long in this country and we don't know what to do, but look at how it's spreading through our children. Be afraid, be very afraid. The illness was identified as being caused by enterovirus D68, but the neurological complaints leading to a partial paralysis was new. And yeah, like, how nice. So it's some sort of D68 virus that now has some sort of newfangled complications. Petri dish, mix it up. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco used genetic sequences obtained from the virus, which were cultured from 25 children with limb paralysis in Colorado and California between November 2013 and October of 2014. And they found that the viruses were genetically very similar, sharing mutations founded in the polio virus genome. But they also identified a novel strain of enterovirus D68, which they called B1, and identified it as emerging 4 years ago. Now, do you guys remember when we had the bird flu, then we had the swine flu, then we had some sort of pandemic that they were warning about, and whatever that one flu was, I distinctly remember them saying, wow, we've never, ever seen anything like this before. There seems to be a combination of bird flu and swine flu, and there was some other flu, and that was never before seen in nature. And I was like, oh, okay, so it was never before seen in nature. How much do you want me to believe that this just naturally occurred versus some lunatic gone wild in a lab sprinkled with DARPA money didn't just put it in a vial, shake it up, and go, let's see what we get? I mean, this is crazy shit, people. There, you know, once we started seeing that the CDC had vials of anthrax sitting or smallpox sitting for, you know, 30 years that no one paid attention to, or vaults that weren't locked, it should have been our first concern that they weren't taking this stuff seriously. And I don't think they are. I mean, it's like all stops out. Let's let the genies out and see what happens. You know what? Collateral damage and a few hundred dead people, get them afraid to line them up to then, you know, problem, reaction, solution. We'll take care of it, so it doesn't really matter. Says, quote, I do not think it is coincidental that it's around the time that these first cases were described, says Dr. Charles Chu, the study's senior author, to the New York Times. The research group was able to identify the strain through a blood sample taken from a six-year-old boy who had been taken to the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles complaining of trouble moving his left leg. We were fortunate enough to detect it, Chu told the newspaper. Usually we are diagnosing these cases after the fact, when the sample you want is the one taken when they start developing symptoms. The new study, however, shows that not every child infected with the strain will develop paralysis. One sibling pair was infected, but another school-aged girl suffered paralysis in both arms and her torso, while her younger brother experienced no lasting effects. Two children died in Rhode Island and New Jersey during the outbreak, but the role of the virus is unclear. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention asked hospitals across North America to report patients aged 21 years or younger who have developed limb weakness and who had had an MRI exam that showed abnormalities in spinal cord nerve tissue. The Lancet report said enterovirus D68 was first isolated from children with lower respiratory tract infections in California in 1962. It's after this initial identification that there were a few cases reported just up until the early 2000s, when all of a sudden, oh, lo and behold, outbreaks started to occur worldwide. There have now been more than 1,000 cases reported across almost all the states in the U.S. during autumn of 2014. Like I said, how coincidental is that? All right, so where do we go from here? We still got about 20 minutes. There are a couple stories that I want to touch on. One was back from February that I had queued up back from when we were doing the nanotechnology stint for a week or so, and we listened to Eric Drexler and Ray Kurzweil talking about nanobot factories and the different ways for manufacturing. We looked at, you know, the new cancer cures. Step right up, little nanobots gonna cure your cancer, people. This story, and it's actually a video, is titled "Injectable 3D cell factories to fight cancer in the body. And what I find very interesting about this story is that this is the first one that I've run across that actually talks about the 3D cell factories that Drexler had talked about. The one story that had talked about the nanobots curing cancer out of RT had basically made it sound like it was just, you know, one little robot that was going to go to the tumor and, I don't know, inject it or eat it or whatever they were planning on doing. But in this story, they actually talk about the nanorobotic factory building, and it's going to build the factory inside your body. So here, let me connect back up again. Don't think that this stuff isn't all related, people. It absolutely is. You know, they have now created or recreated or mixed up all of these new or reinvented diseases to create the audience who then is going to need all of these new drugs to cure them. They would also be able to use this to, of course, make your neighbors afraid of you because you weren't vaccinated, to get everybody to line up. And that's when the whole world becomes a big petri dish. I mean, it's sporadic now. We can sprinkle it on some different groups within the country. But once everybody gets these newfangled vaccines loaded with the newfangled technologies, and remember, there's not just one type of thing going on. When we looked at Ebola, we found out there were five or six different ways that they are looking at manipulating the immune system now that are in the first rounds of human testing. So anyway, here, let's connect. We'll check this one out. So this is from February 3rd of 2015. Injectable 3D cell factories. Oh, hold on. I don't know what that is. That was something continuing and playing in the background. There, I got it. injectable 3D cell factories to fight cancer in the body. And just listen very carefully to how the researcher describes this.
Eileen Lee fills a syringe with a saline solution that contains tiny rods made of silica. Those rods form the basis of a new method to fight everything from cancer to Ebola in the human body. David Mooney, a professor of bioengineering at Harvard, says the human immune system is the most efficient weapon on the planet to fight disease. But
I'm going to stop for 1 second. So first thing that they said, it can be used to combat cancer to Ebola. Notice how they outline that very clearly. But they're also doing this research at the Harvard University Weiss Institute. If anyone remembers, how many times have we heard about the Weiss Institute, W-Y-S-S? That is exactly where they're working on the RoboBees and the miniaturized unmanned aerial vehicles as well.
But sometimes it needs to be activated to respond to threats. That's where the rods come in.
I want to stop, too, because Harvard, if I am not mistaken, or no, maybe it was MIT. It was MIT is where Drexler had started the nanotechnology program.
Could inject these through a needle because they're so small. And then after they're in the body, they would be present in a fluid, a saline solution or salt solution. And then as that salt solution dissipated into the surrounding tissue, these particles would then collapse on each other and form this three-dimensional structure.
That three-dimensional structure is basically a makeshift laboratory, which takes shape inside the body. First, the tiny lab plays the role of a trap, releasing drug molecules that were implanted into nanopores fitted in the rods to attract immune cells to the structure. Eileen Lee says it's like attracting a mouse with cheese.
We utilize these nanopores to release a factor that brings about millions and millions of immune cells to this local 3D structure. And there, the cells reside in the pores that are formed between the microparticles, and they're able to be then, you know, subsequently programmed to do their job.
At this
They'll be able, what, I don't know exactly what that word was that she said. It almost sounded like sub-secretly programmed, but they can then, they can use these micropores to attract your immune cells like a mouse with cheese. Okay, which I, it almost sounds like we're duping the body then to get our immune cells to go there, and then they're going to reprogram your cells. So I was wondering, you know, they don't give a lot of detail here, and this would be something that maybe we really should dig into, because this sounds to me like we're using some sort of RNAi, which is what we talked about, being able to reprogram your cells, turn switches on and off, to then change your cells, and then they re-release them back into the body. So here, let me play this.
Point, the tiny lab turns into a factory where these cells are reprogrammed and fitted with proteins designed to trigger an immune response in the body.
They will then migrate away from the scaffold, go to the nearest lymph node, and there they instruct the T cells and B cells to proliferate and to activate.
And then your immune system will increase or multiply this effect at several different steps as you move down the immune response.
And that's when the body kicks into action to start combating disease and infection. In animal studies, the research has proven highly effective. David Mooney says it will take years of research to translate the early successes in animal models into therapies for humans. But he's hopeful that his tiny cell factories will become a powerful weapon in the fight against cancer and infectious diseases.
I mean, how scary is that? That's exactly what Drexler was talking about, building these little 3D nano factories to then create designer cells to go in and do other things. And I mean, this may be to go in and work with the immune system, but remember, they're using the same sort of RNAi technology in Monsanto research for new types of insecticides. They're able to prevent absorption of proper nutrients. I mean, they'll be able to do anything once they can create these little nanofactories that then do things inside your body that you're not aware of. So, all right, where do we go from here? Here, there's one more. We had talked about that story quite a number of times. I've mentioned it, and we actually read it. Oh God, it was probably 6-8 months ago. I don't even remember how old it was. About the toxoplasmas, I think it's a virus, a parasite, toxoplasmas that is in cat dung, if you want to call it that. Right, when you're pregnant, you got to stay away from kitty litter boxes because toxoplasmas can cause issues with the fetus. But they've also discovered that that toxoplasmas can literally get into your body and make changes in your brain. And there was, I think he was Russian, this scientist who had been doing research for quite a number of years. Yeah, actually, the original story was from 2012. I think he was Russian. Jaroslav Flerev, or maybe, I don't know, he's somewhere up there. But he had come up with a theory about how, oh, he's Czechoslovakian, sorry. He had come up with a theory on how this toxoplasmas created him, caused him to be more, have an affinity for cats, let's say. And he was saying that he thought that this was some sort of biological, God, I'm losing my train of thought now, evolution that cats had created, you know, kind of like man's best friend with a dog. And we actually read about that too, how dog spit now they found actually mixes with your microbiome. Well, the same thing with cats. So here, there was another video that I had queued up here from a while ago. Study shows parasite could change your brain chemistry. And this is the one about cats with the toxoplasmas, how it literally in mice, they discovered it makes mice not afraid of cats. Hold on. Oh, I hate when this happens. Gonna play. Well, hold on. We'll have to kill this one, and I'll have to read until the internet decides it's going to come back. I don't know. I must have said a keyword. All right. This is titled, How Is Your Cat Making You Crazy? It says, no one would accuse Jaroslav Fligger of being a conformist, a self-described sloppy dresser. The 53-year-old Czech scientist has the contemplative air of someone habitually lost in thought, and yet still his youthful square-jawed face is framed by frizzy red hair that encircles his head like a ring of fire. Certainly, Flavor's thinking is jarringly unconventional. Starting in the early 1990s, he began to suspect that a single-celled parasite in the protozoan family was subtly manipulating his personality, causing him to behave in strange and often self-destructive ways. And if it was messing with his mind, he reasoned, it was probably doing the same to others. The parasite, which is excreted by cats in their feces called Toxoplasma gondii, and is the microbe that causes toxoplasmas, the reason pregnant women are told to avoid cats' litter boxes. Since the 1920s, doctors have recognized that a woman who becomes infected during pregnancy can transmit this disease to the fetus, in some cases resulting in severe brain damage or death. T. Gandhi is also a major threat to people with weakened immunity, and in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, before good antiretroviral drugs were developed, it was to blame for the dementia that affected many patients at the disease's end stage. Healthy children and adults, however, usually experience nothing worse than brief flu-like symptoms before quickly fighting off the protozoan, which thereafter lies dormant inside brain cells, or at least that's the standard medical wisdom. But if Flager is right, the quote-unquote latent parasite may be quietly tweaking the connections between our neurons, changing our response to frightening situations, our trust in others, how outgoing we are, and even our preference for certain scents. And that is not all. He also believes that the organism contributes to car crashes, suicides, and mental disorders such as schizophrenia. When you add up all the different ways that it can harm us, says Flager, toxoplasma might even kill as many people as malaria, or at least a million people a year. Now, how frightening is that to find out that a simple protozoa that is probably... You know, how many people have cats as pets? I mean, it's probably out with millions of people across the world who have cats as pets. They can go in and make changes between the connections of our neurons in our brain. And I'm going to throw something out there again, like yesterday with the Plum Island connection. You know, color me silly to think that the feds probably are taking a look at toxoplasma as a way to potentially manipulate the general public. I mean, if it literally can change your response to fear, trust, outgoing, so how much you share information or connect with others, I mean, wouldn't it be in their best interest to have us all be hermits and not exchange information? Wouldn't it be to their benefit to have us not trust others and build groups of people that we could share ideas with? Wouldn't it not be in their best interest to keep us afraid or to not make us afraid? You know, step right up, become part of the machine, get your 3D nanofactory injected so you'll never be sick again. All right, let me see if this clip will play now. I don't know. This machine's actually been funky again for the last couple of days with its connectivity. Oh, yeah, here we go. So hold on. Let's connect up Skype. So this video is on the toxoplasma. It is called Study Shows Parasite Could Change Your Brain Chemistry.
In today's Morning Rounds, a new study looks at mice. When they're infected with a common parasite, they lose their innate fear of cats. Even when the infection is cured, the mice remains unafraid. That finding can help us understand how disease changes the human brain. Dr. David Agus is a CBS This Morning contributor and professor of medicine at the University of Southern California. Good morning, and tell us about the study.
Good morning, Charlie and Nora. It's a very important study. The study noticed that when mice got a certain infection, they weren't afraid of a cat. They would walk up and get eaten by a cat. And we thought it was inflammation in the brain. And this group at Berkeley then showed that if the infection went away and there was no inflammation, it retained that ability, the non-fear of the cat. And it's important because what it's telling us is that an infection can change the hardwiring of the brain. And that is an important observation.
And go ahead.
This is incredible because this bacteria, Toxoplasma, is the one that pregnant women are warned why they shouldn't touch kitty litter. And yet you're saying that what this study found is that there are permanent effects to the brain that could tell us about disease, right?
Ding, 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 ding. So infections can permanently change the brain. I mean, how frightening is that? There's actually a couple stats that popped up on the screen here from the CDC. More than 60 million Americans may be infected, you know, though your healthy immune system, which, of course, how many people actually have healthy immune systems anymore as we're pummeled on a daily basis from 100 different directions? Healthy immune systems may prevent illness. But, I mean, this is just one parasite. How many others? I mean, look where we started out reading about, what was that gentleman's name? Eric Traub and some of the research that they've been doing since the 30s and the 40s. On different diseases and viruses, and then infecting in animals and using insects, entomological vehicles to then infect animals. And remember, too, we were talking about back in the Ebola, quote-unquote Ebola outbreak, where there were multiple dogs that they ended up destroying because they had talked about the dogs potentially being infected and being a different vehicle for disease spreading. And now we're looking at things such as prairie dogs, this dog flu. I'm just saying put on a seatbelt, people, because there definitely is some evil research afoot here, okay? I'm hoping that you guys can see the dots that I see. And you know what? I hate to tell you, but it looks like we are at the last 20 seconds of the show. How the hell did that happen? All right. Well, hey, it's Thursday. Make sure you guys stick around. We have Kevin Blanch is live up next. Hopefully Kevin is in a good mood today. And then at 6 p.m., we have Mr. Chuck Ocelli live at 6. We have Drew and Chuck on tonight at 10. Antimedia with SM at 11. And Hal Anthony's show from this week runs at 8 p.m. Eastern. So make sure you guys stick around because Thursday is always an awesome night. And we will finish this tomorrow. Everybody, have a great day. Take care.